Welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Listen in as we discuss all things business, growth, and marketing with business owners, thought leaders, and entrepreneurs. And now, here's your host, founder of Roundhouse, the creative agency, Saul Edmonds.
Oh, hey, everyone. Welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Yet again, today, I have the great pleasure of speaking with Sharath Jivan, who is talking from London today, I believe. Is that correct, Sharath?
That's right, Saul. Yeah, very much. It's an early, beautiful morning, actually. The sun is out. It's a nice start to the day.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, so it's thanks so much for being on the podcast. It's great to speak to you. Before we get into our subject matter, something I generally always do for people who haven't encountered you online or in the real world or anywhere, just to give people a bit of a snapshot of who you are and I guess what you get up to, and then we'll be expanding on that during the podcast. Over to you.
Sounds wonderful. So I'm Sharath, as I mentioned. I'm an expert on this idea of inflection moments, helping leaders, individuals, even sort of country societies, if you like, think about the next mountain to climb. And how do you try and navigate that, that sense of how to build and climb that next mountain? It could be, for example, a company which is doing well but feels it can achieve more. It could be someone mid-career who's, you're coasting along quite well, has got a nice salary, comfortable job, etc., but feels like there's something they really haven't, there's an itch they haven't yet explored. It could be, many things in the world out there now. I'm doing some new work on generations, for example. There's a huge shift of wealth, of the workforce, all of these things, and there's expectations as the younger generation comes in. How do we as a society try and navigate that inflection moment as well? So I'm the inflection guy, if you like, as well. We can talk about that when it relates to business and growth and everything else. But just before that, I was a founder CEO for 15 years in education, set up two organizations that reached about 50,000 schools in countries like India, East Africa, Brazil, wow, Indonesia, the UK, where I'm from. Before that, I had a corporate career for about 10, 12 years. I'm the son of Indian immigrants to the UK, and so a minority in my own country. And that also gives me a very different vantage point on the world, I think, and how to think about some of these questions moving forward.
Yeah, sure. I was actually really sort of taken when you first got in contact, and I heard that term, in inflection moments. And then the next thing, when you hear, say, a sentence or two, and somebody goes, "Hi, I'm so-and-so," and they go, and they have this book, and that particular term, for me, I guess probably more initially in that little first kind of part in the moment where I was like, okay, I know that you're working with businesses and other people, but that term really kind of grabbed me. And it's something that I want to sort of explore more, because I haven't, I was waiting obviously to talk to you to make sense of it so you could tell me, but like to actually to explore that, because I know that's, what's the title of your current book? It's Inflection.
Yeah, it's called Inflection. Yeah. And the subtitle is Roadmap for Leaders at a Crossroads. And I think that's the way I think about inflection moments in a way, that sense of being at a crossroads, and how do you navigate that crossroads, really?
Sure. And would you also say then too, because like I was thinking about what that word kind of means to me too, and I guess it's but when it comes to somebody's business, I have these conversations, you probably do too, like where you're talking to people either in your industry or all different sorts of people about things that crop up all the time. I mean, you could almost, it sort of seems to me anyway, like inflection moments are almost like a part of business. They are kind of happening quite often. And then you calling your book and this kind of idea, how did you come to place that kind of emphasis, I guess, on that term? Is there some really special importance around that you find?
Yeah, so I think, you know, as I mentioned, I'm sort of I was raised as a Hindu. I'm Indian, and so this idea of karma is what is a strong idea. And I think
Sure.
when I was the founder CEO for those 15 years, what I realized is that, you know, the day-to-day mattered for sure, and of course, like how you execute, how you deliver on what you promise, all of those, how you manage a team, they matter. But actually, when I look back at, say, that 15-year period, there were maybe three or four really key chapters. And how we navigated those new chapters, or how we, you know, got into them, first of all, recognized there were new chapters in the first place, really made a profound difference in how well the organization did. And even now, actually, I can look back and the scarring both ways. When it went well, it, you can see some of the long-term effects. But when I made perhaps a not such a good decision at that point, you can see some of the, you know, the symptoms. Many years I've handed over the organization, but still, you can still see that happening. So I think this idea that not all leadership time is created equal is the core idea, that you have these moments. And what's difficult, I think, as a as the owner of a business or a CEO or whatever, is knowing that you are at an inflection moment. And so the book, one of the first ideas is, how do you diagnose if you are at one versus something more day to day? And I like to think of it in terms of sort of asteroids and starships, that asteroids are these things coming from outside about to hit you or have hit you. It could be a new regulation, a market change, a shift in customer preferences, a change in how regulation works, public opinion works in your sector. The starship is much more about what happens internally. Maybe there's a leadership change or a governance change, or perhaps there's a shift in the workforce towards a new, a younger workforce, those kinds of things internally. And usually, when you have the asteroid and the starship happening often at the same time, that's a pretty good sign you're at an inflection moment if you're a business owner.
Is the difference then that the you're able to steer the shot the starship, but you can't the asteroid?
I think you can do both. You can manage the asteroid. You can't, yeah, you can't control it, but there are
Yeah, you
things you
can
can
manage it.
shift
Yeah,
towards.
you could yeah, that's right. That's an interesting parable, I suppose, there too, because the assumption is that you can steer the starship because there's people inside it and you have a level of control, but there's still external factors with something like an asteroid that you can manipulate it still, right?
Yeah, you can at least influence. So even if you can't influence, you can at least be responsive to it and agile and think smartly about how you yourself respond wherever possible. I mean, so let me give you a real example to bring it to life. So I've been doing some work with the B Corp movement, and some of your members might be familiar with it. It's a certification where companies can actually certify themselves and then independently verify that they are socially responsible. In terms of their impact on society, their workers, the environment, et cetera. In the UK, it's reached about 3% of GDP as a movement. So about 2,000 businesses have come on board, but they've created a lot of grounds for some of our biggest national companies and are part of this movement. But the leaders of the B Corp certification felt like going from 3% to 5% was not where they want to go next in the UK. They wanted to think about more systemic work, maybe how they work with regulators, with investors, public opinion, for example, and what business should be doing to create a bit of better world. And so some of that inflection has been shifting from certifying more and more companies, which they'll still keep doing, of course, to actually thinking about other ways they can have influence, they can have impact, but also be a sustainable organization at the same time. So yeah, those are kind of examples where a lot of it, you know, sometimes it comes at us and we have to respond, and it can be a maybe a mini crisis, a turnaround that happens, of course. But wherever possible, if we can anticipate that's about to happen and get ahead of it as a business owner, we're going to be in much safer territory. So the best time is the classic sort of the best time to, you know, when it, fix a leaking roof is when it isn't raining, right? That kind of idea that you have that time to step back, think about the future, really future-proof where you want to go. That's the work I typically do and what I tend to write about as well.
Yeah, sure. So you had there was another book too, Intrinsic. And once again, we've got these great words that you're using too, which are quite is a I find like from I'm from somebody that's always or not always, but often dealing with metaphors and meaning in visual things. I find like the use of words in this way, sort of quite nice, like in a sense that it gives a really specific focus, you know, before, especially for me, because I can only reflect on, say, you know, how I first respond when I hear something and I'm going, oh, inflection, okay, that's this, then I talk to you to find out. So when, because you've got Intrinsic Labs too, right? Like that's, yeah, that's exactly. So the word, so is there a relationship, a specific relationship between you using the word sort of intrinsic and then inflection in what you currently do? And if so, what's the relationship between them? Like their meanings, I guess.
Yeah. So my first book was all about intrinsic motivation. How do we try and find it? And my work in education, I've been working with teachers in state schools around the world and looking at how we can help rekindle that. Teaching as a profession, as you know, is going through a huge, you know, motivational challenge with the levels of bureaucracy, people leaving, etc. So my work was about how I ended up working with about 200,000 teachers and how do we help them really want to stay in the profession, want to grow, want to develop, reignite them. They all went in for very strong reasons. They wanted to connect and make a big difference in children's lives, but that can get beaten out of you the longer you are in any kind of system overall. As I started my work, I started working on inflection moments. Some of the things that I realized was that the way that you need to navigate these moments needs to drive back to your intrinsic motivation. So at these moments, there's no right answer. So often what leaders need to do is go back to say, what really drives me as a leader, as a leadership team, as a board, for example, where do I want to go at this moment? I can go probably two or three different ways. All of them could be successful, but what will really give me the stronger sense of internal motivation and the sense that I really am doing, having the most impact in my working life? That's how the two things relate really as well. It's about really thinking about how do you, first of all, carve a path that really feels right to you and feels authentic, but then also, how do you do it in a way that motivates the whole team and brings out their full potential at the same time?
Yeah, I guess is that, yeah, because that motivation, I guess, at the heart of anything that all of us do is really quite important, isn't it? Like that, and to, I guess, even know what that is, because there's an assumption with, you know, I'm sure I could probably, given a bit more time, like think of a number of examples of things that I assume that I understand about myself of why I'm motivated to do certain things, but maybe if I probed a bit further, maybe I would realize I don't, you know, I sort of do, you know, because even if it's like, no, you don't at all, or you sort of do, like the sort of do sort of understanding is probably, you know, just as important as, you know, not at all, because in the sense of, you know, if you're a leader and you have a team, or if you're a teacher, you know, too, I'm sort of seeing relationships between these things here. You're at the head, you're the driving force, you're the driving the ship or the car or whatever. And so, you know, that's, and the idea of leadership is very important for the motivation of all those other people too, right? You know, as to how they feel about what they're doing. How do you find, or maybe if there's even some specific examples of people in the business world, you know, who might be something quite that happens a lot, who have really reached a point where they might be very, very successful, but that kind of intrinsic understanding of why they're doing what they're doing, then at this point, despite success, you know, have you come across that with people going like having these big realizations?
Yeah, I think what tends to happen is I work with a lot of founders, actually a lot of entrepreneurs as well, and entrepreneur businesses. And what I find in many of them is they're driven initially by a real hunger, a thirst to either make it financially. Sometimes they don't always come from the most comfortable backgrounds to begin with when they grew up, or they have something to prove really as well. They want to make their mark. They want to show the world that they matter and they can do it. And those are what I'd call examples of extrinsic or external motivators. And we know that you can go quite far on those things to a point, right? You can set up something, you can be successful. As you said, there is that kind of realization, usually a few years in, or when they've already hit a certain, they've reached their first mountain, right? That's where the things link. That next mountain, it's hard to keep doing the same thing. Even if they still have the hunger, their kids may not, for example, if it's a family business, or their workforce may not the same way. So it's, I think, much healthier to tap into internal motivators or intrinsic motivators that come from within. That's the core definition. So I talk a lot about this idea of purpose. So how do we make sure what we're doing is helping someone else or others each day and every day? Are we really doing that? How do we connect with that every day and make that as a real source of motivation, energy, autonomy? How do we feel that we're in control of our lives and we can actually shape things the way we believe works best and is right? That's the second area. And mastery around really how do we try and get better and better at what we do, and constantly keep learning and growing as an individual, as a leader. So those things, if we can try and recalibrate our dial towards those intrinsic motivators, we're much more likely to be successful overall.
Yeah. And then what are some of the things that you've come across in terms of, say, the external catalysts that have, there's probably like a lot of things here, but, you know, just give like a few that you've sort of seen that have really significant impact, like things that people don't have any control over. Over their values, or that might, to bend people to the will of like some other external force.
Yeah, I mean, they're almost sort of personal inflection moments, actually. So they tend to be, children tend to be a big one, for example. Mm. You know, you're working all the way through your 20s, maybe half of your 30s, suddenly you have your first child. Everything seems to change in terms of priorities. You're a bit stuck and grappling with how to manage that sense of, you know, what mattered to you a lot before doesn't matter quite so much, for example. Mm. Often it's a sense of emptiness, that the sense that you're very busy, you're very successful, you're often very wealthy, but it doesn't really, you know, after more and more money, doesn't seem to really give you the same rush it used to before, for example. Mm. It could be something around a friend or relative or a parent who becomes sick or passes away, or your own health, for example. Those kinds of things tend to happen. The other thing that happens within the business world is, within the core business, is that maybe there's a crisis. Maybe that there's some kind of, you have a fraud, for example, that to deal with, or you have a tough market suddenly, etc. All of these things really start to challenge your core assumptions. That's why stepping back and thinking of it as an inflection moment can be really, really helpful. And trying to shift your motivational dial to be more internal, more driven by what you believe matters can be a very powerful way of addressing those things.
Yeah, I guess it's like the foundation, isn't it? Like it's like realizing what the foundation is of the building, of sort of understanding. That again, like maybe you, we're probably all, there's a lot of things we don't, I probably reflect on, right? You know, you don't really reflect on things often in sometimes you have to have, like you were saying, like a catalyst to do that, the passing of a loved one, or, you know, all sorts of different things. But have you seen any particular any particular things happening more, like say in our current environment now in 2024, when, you know, things are, there's a lot of different external factors, like some of which that don't particularly have a direct effect on people, but have you seen like some of the current environment, and if so, what are some of those things that might be different now than they were in the past?
I mean, clearly the pandemic has had a huge effect, right, in all of our thinking. So I think what made it such a powerful experience that we all, one was, it was a shared experience. We all went through it, right, in different things. I know in Australia, you guys had a pretty tough, sort of lockdowns. Mm. The other thing that happened at the same time, I think, is that it really gave us all time to pause and reflect and step away from the day to day. And I think a lot of people came out feeling quite empty afterwards. And that sense, I think Adam Grant's written about languishing, for example, the sense that, you know, many of us felt like we're not the way we're in terrible shape or anything like that, but are we really, really flourishing in the way we want to as a human being? I think a lot of us had those realizations and thinking, and it's back to you. I love the metaphor you made. It's all about the sort of idea of the building. But even if the building is made on shaky foundations, if you've been building for a while and it's quite high up, you can still go back and reevaluate the foundations and relay them actually as well. So it's never too late. You can always go and rethink about those things. The success you've had will not go away. You've got it now, it's yours. But if you can start to weave that into how you think about the next chapter, it'll be more motivating for you and almost always more successful, but also for your team, for your family, people that you care about around you at the same time.
Yeah, but these sort of things too. I mean, like I like the more – it's funny because the more I tend to do this podcast and I'm speaking to, I mean, to people like yourself and people who are often, for the most part, like either entrepreneurs or people in business. And there's a lot of really, you know, common things that I probably only have now with hindsight because I have so many conversations. And there's these common threads, and a lot of them like actually have to do with what you're talking about, that there's like it crops up all the time, these even though no one except for you has actually called them an inflection moment, they've called them other things. They'll be like, oh, my realization about this or this or that, but that's really common. That's like a really super common thing as to why people even started then what they were currently doing, or why they wrote a book, or you know, there's like all these sorts of things. And I think it's like, whilst some of those things are things you wouldn't willingly engineer for yourself, you wouldn't go, oh yeah, I'm going to make sure, because I, you know, heard somebody said it was a great character building experience to you know, to run my business into the ground or whatever. No one's ever obviously going to do that, but the fact is that these things, you know, still, you know, in a range of different ways, they form who you are, like for good or for whatever. But I just on sort of another topic too. I was reading in my general research about you, and that you like to travel, right? Mm-hmm. And you're the traveler. So because I feel like there's sort of strong relationship between like your sort of love of education and what you've done there, and then learning, and I'm assuming traveling too, of like understanding, you know, and having these experiences. Is that right? Like this sort of relationship between them?
Yeah, great question. So I haven't thought about it in quite that way, but it's a really interesting insight, actually. And I think one of the things that I sort of reflect on myself, you know, when I had my own personal inflection moment, I remember I was driving, my wife is Moroccan, and we were driving with my mother-in-law through the mountains of Morocco. I think it was over for Christmas one year. And just thinking back about, I was very busy doing things, right? I was always, you know, driving a new deal, a new partnership, expanding to a new country, recruiting more people in the team, etc. But the time to actually step back and say, are we doing what we really want to be doing here? Are we really making the most of it? That was less so, I think, as well. And I think, you know, I really empathize with leaders. And that's why I felt I wanted to spend this chapter working with CEOs and leaders and leadership teams to help them navigate these moments, because it's very lonely, first of all. Mm. It's very hard to step back. There's the Koreans say that, even the best barbers should not cut their own hair. And, you know, so that ability to step back and say, look, what am I actually trying to do here? What really matters? How do I carve everything around that idea and where I want to go? I find it very personally quite difficult at times as well. Yeah. I think what I've learned to do, I think perhaps in this new career, has been, I've been doing it about 4 years now, but stepping out and almost zooming out and being able to be more of an observer, listen quite deeply, observe more, be really curious about the world and what's going on. And I think that's, as you said, links to travel. I love going to a new place. I'm not a an all-inclusive person. I hate sitting on a beach all the time. I know I'm on the beach a bit, but the idea of actually going into a, you know, a new place, seeing what's happening in a cafe, in a restaurant, on the street, in a taxi, whatever it might be, it's so fascinating. I really love that sense of learning and seeing how other things are done. I think we can take that kind of traveler mindset as CEOs or leaders and apply that to our own work. I think we'll be better leaders as a result.
Yeah, there was, I can't remember, and I sort of said that too, I guess, because I can't remember who said it to me recently, but they were saying specifically, maybe I heard it on a podcast, but they were talking about how, I mean, one of the best ways to you know, to learn and to understand, you know, people world is to travel. And that makes a lot of, I mean, sense to me too, like whether you're traveling. But I guess the real meaning behind that is partially the travel itself, but it's really the experiences and probably what your, if I was to sort of try to break it down, I would imagine too that, like, if you're doing that, and especially if you're doing what you were talking about before, like you're taking the time to listen and observe, which perhaps people are doing unless they're on a, you know, a fast-paced cruise ship and someone's going, and now we're going to go here and now we're going to go there, in which case you're probably not. But if you're traveling and you're enjoying yourself and you're absorbing what's around you, then there's probably going to be a different sort of focus on those experiences. And sometimes, like, and those little things, like, you just, like, observe something, which, you know, then is travel. But then I guess that idea can be anywhere too, if you're in the correct, like, state to let that in, I suppose, and to observe and watch too. And I suppose, like, that's then all these things are very tightly aligned with, you know, people's love of sports and spending time with their family and, like, having nice experiences and, like, eating nice food and all that sort of stuff, right? At these moments, because it's sort of, it's still not whether it exactly blows my mind, but those times where you kind of go, you know, that time is sort of fleeting, it's going past, and then everything that we have are these moments and memories. And so therefore, for me, it kind of follows that moments are kind of almost everything, you know, those, like, individual moments, because that's all you end up, like, actually having is because as soon as you've experienced something, it's gone. Yeah, it's then in the past. So it's then constantly lives in you as a memory or a moment, you know. So to make the most out of those moments, and I guess tying that into, you know, things like lifelong learning and an interest in, you know, that sort of observation, which we've been talking about, you know, sort of observing people, and then that inflection moment, like the importance of them. And I find it really fascinating, because it's a bit more the sort of language. I mean, I don't know whether you, I mean, if you're like this, but I do as a first time observer, and I'm speaking to you, is that it's a bit more poetic in a way than the usual business related language. It's sort of which, and I'm only saying that because I like it. It's kind of interesting to me that's, but it's got, you know, it's a good starting point, because it gives, like, this is going to have meaning. And then, just because of the use of, language too. So so speaking about, like, the things you've done, say, in education, what was your original background before you actually started all this, and before you were doing all the education stuff? What were you doing before then?
Yeah, so maybe just going back to what you said about moments, I really agree. And I think we know, like, from all the research that, you know, experiences is another way of saying that they matter so much more than things, right? And I think we tend to accumulate a lot of things. And I spend with my family quite a bit of our sort of annual budget on travel. We try and travel a lot every year. I don't think I've ever regretted doing that actually as well, because you have those moments with your children. I think often in I'm sure like in many households nowadays, our lives are quite scheduled, they're quite high pressure, we're always doing things, there's a bit of a drill that has to happen each day. We're trying to reduce that as well, but that's still part of life. And the chance just to have time away where you're experiencing something together can be so, so powerful. And because I used to work in such interesting countries like Indonesia, Uganda, or India, I'd be working there over the summer as I was running the education organizations. And we put our kids into school there over the summer as well. And that was amazing for them to spend a couple of months with peers from a very different country and culture and just get on with it. It wasn't for the educational point, but just more that they could have an experience like that as well. So if we are lucky enough to do that, I really encourage it. I think when we're traveling also for work, we see the world in a very different way as well, because we're working with others. We're seeing how society is organized, how things get done. It's fascinating also. And again, I think it's really, really powerful. I think going back to what you said about what I was doing before the education, I was in the corporate world. So as I mentioned, I'm the son of Indian immigrants, and that had many very, very powerful things and a real desire to achieve. I was the first generation of my family into the UK from India, from the south of India. But at the same time, I think there was a lot of pressure that I put on myself really to do conventional things and climb conventional ladders. And those conventional markers of success were very important to me. So I went to Cambridge University for my undergraduate degree. I went into a top consulting firm right after. But what I hadn't really created as much space for me to think about, what do I really want to do? And I had some sense of it. Maybe I just wasn't courageous enough to pursue it. I don't think it was a bad way to start, because I learned the ropes. I worked in environments with very smart people, many of whom I'm still in touch with. I got to see how a really high performing organization works. So lots of transferable skills, but I did know that there was an expiry date on that sort of chapter of my life. And I wanted to do something maybe a bit quirkier, a bit more aligned to my own values. And for me, education was always something that, as an immigrant, was always very, very heavily emphasized in my own parental upbringing and so on as well. And the sense that I was very lucky, I'd sort of was on the right side of that Bavarian lottery because of that environment, I think. But lots of people didn't have that same chance. I think that was always a big value. I always spent a lot of summers in India when I was a kid, visiting grandparents and so on. So yeah, maybe that after that first 10 years, the next 15 years became, really being that entrepreneur education and trying to expand quality education for millions of children actually around the world. And that was my second chapter. And now I'm in the third one of being a leadership advisor, helping a range of companies and organizations think about their inflection moments as well.
I sort of asked that question too, because generally I always love hearing a good origin story, but as you start to sort of explain the different parts of what you've done, it becomes more and more clear as to the relationship between those things as to because you I think you mentioned it before too, like you obviously had one or more inflection moments of your own. So if you want to share it, like if you had a particular one or inflection moments in those early days, like in between, quite early before you actually when you were coming out and you were you did your training and you were not sure whether you should go into something or not, but you did it. Were there any particular inflection moments there that are really significant for you?
Yeah, so I was 2 years into my career. I was working for a really high flying consulting firm. It was really hard to get into the firm and so on. And I still had a very big passion for international development, for what was happening in emerging countries and looking at those things. And I took a year off, largely unpaid, to go and work with ActionAid, the big international NGO. And I became a sort of almost like a chief of staff, their CEO, for a year to learn how that sector works. And I remember my parents just wondering, and lots of people saying, what the hell are you doing? Like, you're in this sort of really, on this kind of almost golden, what's it called? Roller coaster, if you like, up going up, or golden piece going up, or golden escalator, sorry, was a better word maybe. And what are you doing here? And I think it would be very easy to have gone and just kept going up the ladder, and maybe I would have made partner or something and probably be a lot wealthier than I am now in some ways. But there was something in me that I really wanted to explore, and I felt gave me meaning, it gave me purpose again. I wanted to also carve my own path. There was quite a strong part of me, I think, that didn't want to be working on someone else's sort of rhythm and structure, that I wanted to really be more independent and in charge of my own life. And what I also wanted, I also wasn't, the analytical side of consulting was great, I enjoyed it, but I wanted to be a much more broader, more human leader, I think, and learn those more stronger people skills and the ability to influence and build ideas and get people behind me. That's what really excited me as well. So it was a real shot in the dark. In fact, I did that for a year. Then I went and set up a company in the dot-com heydays in Singapore after that, and then eventually went back for a couple of years into the consulting firm. They very kindly paid for my business school education, so I had a kind of bond to go back for a couple of years. It was painful, I've got to admit. You know, going back was quite a tough experience, but it sort of was a bit of a finishing school. It gave me some additional things I learned. But after that, I really went full throttle into what I wanted to do as well. So maybe it took me about 12 years to get onto that path. And part of me just still wonders, was that the right thing to do? Was it better to... could I have gone and just gone straight into, you know, what I did in education? I know many people have done that straight after university, for example. At the same time, I do think life is long, and actually having that range of experiences, working that experiences, being able to see different worlds, working in corporates, working in non-governmental organizations, working in the public sector, in startup, etc., it gave me a very wide base of networks, of experiences, of perspectives and understanding. And I think I became a much better leader as a result of that, because I had to work with many of those kinds of partners. But also as an advisor now, I've worked in all of those sectors, and I have clients in all the sectors as well, because I've been part of it and learned and experienced that as well. So yeah, sometimes it's really hard to know what the right answer was, back to inflection moments more broadly. But yeah, I do think being able to have a little bit of a patchwork at the beginning of a career was a useful foundation for going into that.
Yeah, I often wonder, I mean, I just thought of, I'm sort of similar things myself, like you go down a certain path and people say this or they don't, and there's nobody saying anything to you, and then that can be, you know, that can be better or worse depending on who they are. But like I think my general conclusion, although I'd probably never sign off on this in like a legal document or anything, I'm sure, you know, I don't feel that strongly about it. But like I feel like there's no real specific right path, because like the rightness of it is going to depend on, you know, partially an outcome, which might be soon, or it might be way down the path. It might be like way down the track. It's like the, you know, I sort of often think about like that. There's, you know, if it's sort of clear and easy, say, in things like sport, right, where you go, it's all very sort of logical, and everyone widely acknowledges that, like, an athlete, you know, starts as a amateur here or just as a hobby, they get better, somebody sees promise, or they like doing it. Then really, just in order to get to where they want to go or even have the opportunity, they just have to do a lot of practice. And they kind of have to go on a bunch of faith that that's going to happen because they want to do it. And and so they keep doing it. And, but, you know, often those same kind of methods by which, you know, you just have to do those things to get there. And it's obviously the passion and like strategy and doing things slightly differently to your competition in sort of sport, a whole range of things. They're often, is this sort of thing applied, like we were talking about, of, you know, right or wrong paths, which is, you know, on its own merits, I think that's still important, like to have an idea of that. But the reality of, like you were saying, you ended up realizing then in retrospect that stuff that you did that you didn't particularly want to do ended up being super valuable anyway. Like it ended up being very valuable set of skills that you didn't, you weren't necessarily able to see in that manner at the time, but you could in retrospect, you know, because everyone's, it's all very, things are great in hindsight, right?
Yeah.
Like you can go, it's awesome. You can, you know, you can go, oh, of course, yeah. But, and that's, and I like that though. It's kind of, and I think that's helpful to remember that too. And you become better. It's easy then having more hindsight to go, well, when I do something, something new in the future, now I know that there's a good potential that that could be really useful or not. You know, it may be, I mean, useless. It may have no benefit, but it still like adds to the, in the mix really, doesn't it? Like that sort of idea of lifelong learning. You don't necessarily always have to be super discerning about it. Like, yes, to some extent, like you're not just going to absorb anything and everything, you know, if it's junk, you know, you're not going to.
One of the things I teach at the Oxford's Business School, actually, the Side Business School, and I teach an MBA cohort each year. And so it's such a great chance to work with a younger generation and understand what's on their mind. But one of the things that I think I've sort of really emphasized with them, which I think seems to be resonating, is the idea of this follow your passion stuff is very high pressure, especially early in our life. You know, we may not know exactly what our passions are.
Yeah.
But the idea, instead of following your problem, but being interested in a problem out there in the world that you're just interested in, it might be about, I don't know, climate change or AI or financial services and how it evolves, or how do we meet customer needs better, you know, whatever it might be, you can carve it a number of ways, but just having interest in a problem, and that problem might change over time, that's fine. But as a result, you can do so many different things if you know that problem. So let's say you're interested in climate change, for example, you might start off your career as a consultant or in a investment bank or something, raising finance for new startups, for example. You might then decide to go and work in a larger company that is in that sector. You might then become an entrepreneur. You might then become, you know, successful. Then you might teach, for example, or write, or be an advisor, for example. There's just so many different paths you can take. But I think often we get very fixated on the actual, the job itself and the role, rather than the wider problem. And instead, if we use the problem sort of framework of thinking about it, our careers can evolve quite organically. We can be open to new things, but we're still building understanding and knowledge about something we care about quite deeply. But we can also embrace different kinds of ways of contributing to that problem over the course of our careers as well. And I think AI will just make that even more important, that those career changes, those inflection moments will accelerate, I think, in our careers also.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's an interesting point, because I wonder if some of that of, you know, having or not having your focus on the actual job, the job role, the job description, and putting the emphasis on some of those core things like we've been sort of speaking about in a range of different ways, is then linked to, you know, the idea of authenticity too, because that's a term like everyone uses that these days. It's, you know, everyone's like throwing around authenticity, authentic, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And everyone kind of knows what it means. But then I was actually just thinking about this the other day. I can't remember. It was just one of those, you know, I mean, you go down a mental rabbit hole and you start thinking about things. And I was like, in order to say when people go be authentic, in itself is like a it's not quite logical to me, because in order to do that, you can't particularly just engineer it, because then it wouldn't be being authentic. You can, is it true? I mean, maybe you can speak to this, is it then just being aware of particular things and you come to the realization of what that actually means to be and being comfortable doing that? Is that then the authenticity? Because for me, those things are kind of closely aligned to, you know, all the things we've been talking about like, you know, understanding yourself and going, okay, an inflection moment. Like, I wouldn't imagine that it would be more difficult for somebody to do that if they haven't got like as much of a handle on themselves and like authenticity. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think the best way to unlock authenticity, I define authenticity being the best version of ourselves we can be. It's really important.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
a bit like passion or following a passion, it puts a lot of pressure, especially on younger people in their careers. And I'm not sure always that's the most helpful way of thinking about it. I think instead, what can be better is actually falling in love with something bigger than yourself. So you become, because I think the authenticity stuff is very inward looking, and that can be helpful.
True. Yeah.
But another way to do it is to think about something that almost dissolve into something bigger. So for me, education was such a big problem. I didn't have time to sort of think about what I was, you know, I just had to do what I had to do. I had to set up partnerships with governments. I had to fundraise. I had to create partnerships. Just so many things that I'd never been trained to do properly, to be honest, but I had to do them. And because there was a bigger reason for it, something that I really cared about. Then as a result, I discovered many strengths about myself I didn't know I had. I discovered many things I needed to work on that I didn't know I needed to work on. So I think this whole imposter syndrome stuff comes from the sense of being quite self-conscious and feeling like the burden of expectations can be very high on us, especially early in our career. One way I found that to get rid of all that stuff, or to lessen its load, is to think about a bigger problem. Again, back to that problem piece. If you really care about something bigger than you, then you can, it gives you a license to go and just go fully at it and see what you can do. And through that, you discover a lot about your authenticity through that process as well.
Yeah, yeah. I think the discovery thing's important part of that is that, and it kind of, you know, you actually said it in a much more eloquent, clear way than I did. So thank you.
Because
I think what I was trying to sort of to get at was that like you only kind of have to go through this journey to realize it. And the journey to realize it is not to actually self-reflect. It's actually to do something else. It's actually to have this other thing, which is a catalyst that's outside of you where like other people are relying on you. And it's really about other people. And I mean, that gets back to, you know, just like generally things that most people accept are sort of good and true. It's like helping others and just doing, it's not just a, you know, an idea that, that people go, oh, these are the good things you should do to be a good person. Like it's actually really true. Like these things are, they're actually really important, you know, self tools as well, like through, you know, that's actually the thing that sort of grows you, really. Like it, and yeah, because if I actually think about most things that I find meaningful, you know, or where I go or I've enjoyed something, a lot of those things are related to like I'm there and I'm participating, but they're often relating to other people and like things that feel, you know, that give me real meaning, like my family and like seeing other people happy or like helping a client or doing that gives me, it doesn't mean that I don't get joy and happiness from things that I do for myself and I feel healthy and, you know, that are all this sort of stuff. But it's a different sort of meaning when it's for somebody else. And that's the education a piece too is really great. And is that something, is that something that you're still doing, the whole education side of things?
No, not as a leader, as a CEO anymore, but definitely as an advisor. So about 20% of my work is with education organizations. I work with everything from tech companies to nonprofits, to governments, to sporting bodies, cultural organizations. So very, very diverse. But yeah, a good chunk of it is in education. I love working with education organizations. Obviously, they have a huge difference on young people, and helping them grow, have an even bigger impact is a big part. So everything from like leading universities to school chains to education startups or NGOs and so on as well. But yeah, it's a big, big passion as well.
Yeah. And so have you seen, like, is there any particular big changes or, I guess, you know, movements or things that you see are going to be a big change in the future for education that you're seeing now in 2024?
I think the worlds of education and work are going to really collapse. I mean, they're going to sort of combine into each other is what I really see. And back to your point of lifelong learning, I think that's going to be the biggest shift, that we won't see education as one one stage of life where you sort of going to spend, I don't know, 15 years or 10 years studying, go into perhaps higher education or then a job. You'll have that, but I think all through our lives, we'll have to keep retooling and relearning. And it's that iterative cycle. I think we'll see education much more in that lifelong learning domain. And so some of the work, I think earlier on in your school education or university education is, how do you build the foundations back to your metaphor of the house so that we have that lifelong learning muscle and that we know how to keep tapping into that at those key points and recognizing those career inflection moments where we have to keep retooling and reevaluating what we want to do as well. So I think there'll be a lot, as you said, a lot of action for a few years. We might work and maybe we'll build a company for a few years. We really enjoy it. We get a lot out of it. But then we think, okay, I've hit this. It's hit a plateau now. I can keep doing it or I can do something else. I might want to go back and study and learn some new things, for example. While I'm doing that, I might go and do something else in my next chapter. So, I think it'll be a longer weaving through our lives. But I think as a result, we've got to make sure that we create the right foundations for our young people earlier on so they can do that retooling really easily.
Is that about just being curious too? Because, like, could you be a great lifelong learner and not be a curious person? Like, are those two things mutually exclusive or are they? Because for me, like I said, I might actually change my opinion on this depending on what you say, but like I feel like I shouldn't say can't, but very difficult or a lot more difficult to have that as a part of your life, lifelong learning, unless you're naturally curious, have it within yourself to be curious about things and like other people. And, it flows through the stuff we were talking about before, like you want to travel. I mean, you might want to travel just because you want to see some nice place. But generally, I sort of feel like a lot of things like that, like I'm not only travel, but like wanting to go and have this experience that you've never done before, or like listen to or being a good listener is because you're curious, like what's going to be around the corner. And it's not just because, it's going to be a great tool in my tool belt. It's because like it's non-specific. And then you sift that out for particular uses, like as required.
Yeah. So I think, probably the one place where you could perhaps be a lifelong learner and not be curious maybe is when there's a scaffold already given for you. Let's say you're a doctor and every 2 years you've got to pass a new exam, which is quite common for doctors if they're going into a new specialty, for example. So that everything is sort of laid out for you. So you could just say mechanically you follow those steps. So in that sense, you're playing a game, you're doing it because you need the next qualification. So I think there are ways to do that. But I just think, especially with AI coming on, a lot of the boundaries between what we do and sectors and jobs will really start to sort of collapse. And there'll be so much more fluid movements between sectors and occupations and roles. That's why I think curiosity will be critical, because no one is going to give us that scaffold in many roles nowadays, or many careers, sorry. We will need to figure that out for ourselves. So I think in a very sort of structured career path, if you're in one career, you could get away with it. But I think curiosity is one of the most important things that we need to nurture earlier on in life. And the way we've built our education systems in general has been very much with a kind of, a have-to mindset of these are the exams, what you have to learn. We're not really giving much space for young people to explore what really makes them curious about the world. I do think we need to shift that. And even in companies, we don't have great learning systems that way, right? We tend to be very menu-driven, quite mechanical with a lot of our learning and development as well.
Yeah, it's where those worlds really collide, isn't it? It's the world of like have-to. And even sometimes the world of like, things that have, like you were saying, a scaffold around them. It's like, where do those two, because sometimes there's going to be, having curiosity is at odds with that. It's going to be at odds. And sometimes it might be, it was like, oh, that's nice, but it doesn't fit into the framework. But it's an interesting point because I'm working in tech and doing the things that we do. And I see like, how, like just in our industry with, visual things and visual audio and how things like AI in some instances are enhancing. And it's a little bit like, you know, certain things relating to technology, there's a sort of Wild West period where it's all guns blazing and everyone's going, everything's AI, and then sometimes often they're using the term and it really has no application to what the thing is. It's just the term, you know, because it's widely used. And I was like, I don't even know what that means. But yeah, you know, it's like things go through those cycles of then having this sort of very heavy usage, then people go back and then it merges with other things. Then people find like the tides kind of like even out, and you end up going, okay, the boat isn't too rocky anymore. It's sort of sitting nicely and you're working out what the correct path is, you know, across the sea, like and I feel like with things specifically like AI, that we're in that sort of rocky period, exciting and interesting, but we'll see, I suppose. But just as we're nearing the end of the things we're talking about, can you also speak a little bit about future-proofing success, because you talk about that a bit, right? Like as to some of the sort of key points in relation to, you know, these idea of inflection moments and intrinsic principles, and like what are some of the things that, you know, foundational things to think about in terms of future-proofing, if that's possible, because that term's used a lot, right? It's like future-proofing.
I think you can future-proof. So I think there's a lot we can do consciously to try and future-proof our success and what we want to build, both in our organizations, our companies, but also in our lives as a whole. And I think what makes inflection moments so tricky is you've got multiple time periods. You've got the long-term, short-term, medium-term. I think of it almost like a watch where you've got the hour hand, minute hand, second hand. And I think about the hour hand being more like direction, where we want to go. The minute hand being about our potential and those around us, and the second hand being about motivation and culture, and the dial is your lifelong learning piece. How do you keep learning as you go on that journey of inflection? So I think what I'd say, what I've seen having worked with, you know, dozens of leaders and teams as they go through inflection moments, is that if you can start with the long term first, really figure out what that long term authentic direction is that you want to go, that really feels unique to you and your organization. You're not trying to copy someone else or trying to just do something a bit better. You're trying to create real sort of blue ocean and be different in where you stand out, for example. So I'm working, for example, with a diagnostics company in medical devices. They're amazing work on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diagnosis. And we've been looking at sort of what is that authentic direction. It's about how they partner with retail chains, how they try and get trust with the medical community earlier, things that are really unique to them. If you can build that early on, so that becomes your long-term DNA and that North Star you're going for, it puts you in a very different place to everyone else in your market or landscape. Once that's clear, then you can say, well, okay, that's where we're trying to go directionally. That's built on us understanding the problem differently as well. So they think about diagnosis in a different way. That's more about socially driven, more about trying to really connect with those who aren't yet ill, but really want thinking about on that cusp. How do you build a team towards that? So what do I need to build in terms of a high performing team? What kind of elements? How do I build a culture that nurtures their full potential and also keeps them deeply motivated? That's the minute and second hand. And then finally, how do I keep building an organizational learning muscle, which I can keep evaluating, am I on the right track or not as I go on that sort of journey? So yeah, just really being very explicit about the idea that there are these different time horizons, starting long-term and then going medium-short is what I'd really recommend on that future-proofing. Because then you're sort of thinking about that next mountain and you're trying to really focus on the climb to that next place.
I think that's really good. I like the way you're breaking it down to these really foundational things, and the use of the clock with the different hands is a really great visual too. I don't think I've actually heard anyone quite break it down like that too. So I hope that people listening to actually get something out of that, because I did. Like, that's a good, it's a good visual way, and it's not the thing that I've sometimes heard about future-proofing, is talking about specific sort of actions and things, which I mean, things have, that has its own, I mean, a value too, not taking away from any things in specific circumstances, but you breaking it down in these very foundational elements was really great. And I actually found that it's a good bunch of visual cues there to help to think about it a bit more. So also, Sharath, you've got a quote, I believe, that you would like to share with us, as is our habit to do on this podcast.
Yeah, so I'm going to give you two quotes, if that's okay. One, for myself, one from, I'm going to re-quote what I shared earlier. So the first one is that not all leadership time is created equal. So if you're listening to this and you're a leader or a business owner, just remember that, yeah, the day-to-day execution matters. What you do, all that stuff is very, very important. But you do have these kind of moments of inflection where you've got to think about what the next mountain is to climb. Try not to do that in the way you run your day-to-day business. That's the key insight. Right. That really, it's really important to step away and think about that long-term, medium-term, short-term. Think about how you align that, where you want to go, and how that links to your own motivation in terms of where your business might go in the future. Second thing is what I said about the Koreans, that sense of the barber, best not to cut your own hair or try to. Yeah, often working with someone, I have obviously worked with a lot of leaders around the world, but the book also talks a lot about that. But try to reach out, try to get help and support. It can be very lonely at those moments of inflection. So anyone who can really be an accountability partner, can be a sounding board, help you step out and zoom out so you can do that future-proofing. Those two things, I think, would be the two things I'd leave us with.
That's great. There's a lot of value to unpack there for people, I think. That's really, really interesting. And I like your the manner in which you've sort of explained. It's like it's a clear reflection for me how you probably think about things. So thank you. And thanks again. And so before we wrap up too, for people who want to learn more and want to find out about you, what's the best place for them to go? We'll have links in the description too, but where do they go, Sharath?
So I have an ongoing newsletter on Substack, which I'll send you. So please, delighted if anyone would like to just follow me on there. I write quite regularly, usually once a week, and it's free. LinkedIn, of course, you can connect with me there as well. And the two books are Inflection and Intrinsic on Amazon. As well, the Inflection just came out about a few months ago. It's all about that long-term, medium-term, short-term, that dial, and how to think about future-proofing our success and those of our organizations as well. But love feedback. And if there are ideas or experiences that listeners would like to share, yeah, please reach out as well, and more generally connect as well. I'd be delighted.
Yeah, sure. And you've got a website too?
It's intrinsic-labs.com.
Yeah.
So okay. Intrinsic-labs.com, yeah.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much yet again for being on. It's been super interesting, and thanks everyone for listening again to the podcast. I think we're now up to you'd be pleased to know, Sharath, I think you're episode 64 or 65. So thank you for playing a part with in the podcast. So appreciate it. And goodbye everyone, and we'll see you again soon. And say goodbye to everyone, Sharath.
Good night, everyone. Please stay in touch and remember to, I'm sure you'll navigate your inflection moments really well.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Grow Your Business. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time here at the Grow Your Business podcast.